Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. Our top story this week is the New York primary, where hometown guy Donald Trump cleaned up, getting 89 of the state's 93 delegates. That's his second biggest one-state delegate haul of the entire primary season. He won all of Florida's 99 delegates on March 15th. Now, Trump's closest rival, Ted Cruz, who a while ago disparaged what he called New York values, was shut out in the state. And longest of long shots, John Kasich, picked up the remaining four New York delegates thanks to a strong showing in Manhattan. So what do you make of New York, Jay? Any surprises there? And I guess more important, do you think it changes the trajectory of the race in a significant way?
I hate to make this sort of a dull show, but no and no.
You could never surprises. Make this a dull show, Jay.
Right. I do my best. It was Trump's home state. I guess the margin surprised me a little bit. I thought there would have been more sort of upstate resistance, folks who may have New York values, but perhaps not Manhattan values. I guess that surprised me a little bit. Kasich did sort of surprisingly – well, I mean, not surprisingly. Again, Cruz sort of shot himself in the foot because who knew that New York would ever matter in a primary. But
right.
It's not surprising. I don't think it changes things dramatically. Everyone always expected Trump to win most, if not all, of the New York delegates, and he did. So
yeah, and you know – I guess what surprised me a little bit, and maybe it shouldn't have, was that, I said that Trump was the hometown guy, and he was, but, the place where he's most associated with in New York is, of course, Manhattan, and that's where he did the worst in the state, and John Kasich did considerably better. So I guess I was a little bit surprised that Kasich ran so strong in that area. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think I'm always a big believer that so much of our life, our society, our politics – turns on class issues that we don't talk about and are afraid to talk about. And Trump lives in Manhattan, but he's from Queens.
Gotcha.
And let's not forget that. And I think people who live in Manhattan don't forget that.
He's not one of them. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I think that's it. His appeal is not to other rich folks. In fact, it's he's Rodney Dangerfield at the Bushwood Country Club.
I mean,
it's so.
Yeah, and I think I agree that it really doesn't change the trajectory of the race in any way. It seems to me like things are pretty much how they were before New York, in that Trump has a narrow path to get to the nomination before the convention, but it's going to be a pretty close thing. And this is going to come down to the very bitter end, I would say.
I think so, too. And I think the thing that Trump needs to start doing now, and maybe he's trying a little bit, is to make the case for his electability in a general election. Because it seems to me it's unlikely he'll get the number of delegates to clinch it outright, and he will have to make that case to either the party leaders or to the delegates. And I don't know, can he make the case that he would win New York over Hillary? Yeah, I don't know. Pennsylvania is going to be interesting because that's one of those states that is. It's an up for grabs. I think it's a state that is winnable by a Republican. Whether or not that Republican's Donald Trump, that's sort of the question he has to answer.
Pennsylvania is sort of an interesting state. And of course, Pennsylvania comes up on Tuesday, April 26th. And Pennsylvania is one of five northeastern states that votes on that day. And for the Republicans, they have, it's 229 delegates that are up for stake. And that's like 18.5% of the 1237 that's needed for the nomination. And Pennsylvania, by far the biggest one on Tuesday, with 71 delegates. But what's interesting to me is the very unusual process Pennsylvania has for awarding them. Because the statewide winner is only going to get 17 of those delegates, and the remaining 54 are elected by congressional district, and they're not obliged to vote for any particular candidate. So the right. voters are going to be voting for delegates, and there's no indication on the ballot of which presidential candidate those delegates may be inclined to support. And of course, Trump, who for a while now has been whining, I'll say, about the unfairness of the process. I mean, this is exactly the sort of thing that he's talking about, you know, and Pennsylvania is going to be a big deal. And this is the kind of thing that rewards kind of deep, long-term organization of the sort that Trump's done very little of.
Well, I don't know that's unfair. That's kind of like saying the NFL rewards good quarterbacks. I mean, that's sort of
those are the rules
of the game. Right, yeah. And you know that going in. If you want to say that the rules ought to be changed at some point, you ought to either make that argument before or after, but making it during sort of rings hollow.
Oh, yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I think that, you know, Trump.
But I mean, there will be a sense, though, of how well Trump will play in a general election in Pennsylvania.
Sure, because Pennsylvania is a fairly, you know, moderate, can be a swing state. Absolutely,
I would say could be a swing state. Most of the time goes Democrat.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's one of those that it for example, John Kasich, coming from Ohio, he was born in Pittsburgh, in the Pittsburgh area. Has some roots, has that same kind of connection. Would do well. There in a general, I think. Hillary Clinton, you know, again, would be the same. She'd have sort of the Democratic machine operating especially Philadelphia and to some extent Pittsburgh, I think, too. I guess this is sort of the test of how is he resonating there after now that we're sort of in like Trump 0.2, I guess. You know what I mean?
Sure. Trump 2.0. He's trying to become a kinder, gentler Trump, except for occasional, you know, vocal impressions of Indian call center workers and that sort of thing. So he can't help himself, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, and Trump is actually polling pretty well in Pennsylvania. Right now, he's somewhere in the mid-40s and Cruz is well behind him. He's definitely going to win the overall statewide vote in Pennsylvania. The question is how many delegates is he going to pick up? And that's right. That's definitely, we're not sure about that. Now, on the Democratic side, at least in New York, things were considerably closer. Hillary Clinton won 58% of the vote and just about the same percentage of the delegates. She came out with 139 of them to 108 for Bernie Sanders. And that doesn't really change the trajectory of that race at all either, you know. And now, on April 26th, on Tuesday, the Democrats have 462 delegates up for grabs, and that's around 19% of the 2383 that they need for their nomination. And but again, because they have that proportional system, that lack of winner-take-all or even winner-take-most rules, it's extraordinarily unlikely that anything that happens there is going to really change the trajectory of that race. I mean, at this point, we kind of know what we're getting with these races. And so I think all the stories about, you know, the big buildup about what could happen, it's trying to make something out of nothing. I think we kind of know where we're at this point, and that's not going to change, especially on the Democratic side. At least I don't expect it to. What do you think?
No, I agree. I agree that the Democrats nomination has been sealed for some time. Again, with my usual asterisks, barring some revelations from the Justice Department, some you know, big shock like that, that might cause the superdelegates to switch. It's obviously Hillary's nomination.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, back to the Republicans, because they're a lot more interesting. I'd say despite that big New York win, as we said before, Trump has a tough road to 1237 for the nomination. But even so, in the last week or so, a lot more people who are supposedly in the know seem to be preparing for Trump as the nominee. If you take a look at the political prediction markets, they suggest that the Trump nomination has somewhere between a 60 to 70% probability. Now, that's hardly a sure thing, and God knows political prediction markets have been wrong before, but his odds seem to be trending upward. And so Trump's been trying to make nice with the Republican establishment, sort of, I think, trying to insure them largely through spokespeople, because they can do a lot more of that insuring than Trump can, that he won't be some sort of nut once he's the nominee. And he's started to promise to build a more traditional fundraising apparatus because, and this is a really important point, I think, that a lot of people don't appreciate. Presidential fundraising mailing lists are hugely important to Republican candidates all the way up and down the ticket. And to this Correct. Point, yeah, Trump doesn't really have anything like that. And that's got a lot of folks really worried.
Yeah, and he can self-fund for a while, but it's not realistic to say, even however much money he has, that he can really self-fund an entire presidential campaign. Yeah, he's trying to make nice with the party folks, although notably he did not appear at the meeting where they discussed the rules. Ted Cruz appeared earlier, Kasich went, Trump did not. And you know, my concern as a Republican is Trump can go and say these things. We have a surrogate say, look, he's really not crazy, which isn't really a great strategy, I don't think. I mean, sort of, you want to come in and say, look, really get to know me, I'm not crazy, not have someone else carry that message for you. But when you've got this much videotape out there, it doesn't really matter if he can convince the Republican establishment that he's not a loose cannon. The fact is that it's all going to be out there on ads, and he'll have to convince the average voter, average non-primary voter, that he's not a loose cannon.
Yeah,
and that's going to be tougher to do when all this is on tape, and you can't just say, well, that was just me in campaign mode, and now I've changed.
Yeah, but I think it's more than just that. I think the conventional wisdom, which of course has been wrong, sometimes disastrously wrong, is that should Trump be the nominee, he's going to get wiped out in the general election. I tend to agree with that conventional wisdom, but that's only the tip of the iceberg in a sense, because if you take a look at Republican candidates from in 2012 and 2014 and even in 2016, they've made considerable use of the mailing list of the connections that Mitt Romney's campaign organization built up. This is the kind of thing that takes, a year and a half to really put together. And it's valuable to a lot more than the presidential race. And what Republicans are concerned about isn't just the presidency, which a lot of them have practically written off at this point, but it's how they're going to do lower on the ticket. It's their hold over Congress. And so Trump hurts them in a number of ways, not just because if he's the nominee, he probably gets creamed, but also that he can't help out his party in the same way that a more conventional candidate would. And honestly, even if
it's not only that he can't help out, it's that he actually hurts, because you will run a side to side panel of Donald Trump mocking disabled reporters or doing goofy Indian accents and so forth with whoever the Senate or House candidate is in any given district.
Yeah, and I don't even know that a big list of Trump fundraisers would be particularly useful to standard Republican candidates, because they are so different. So, looking at it from your perspective, Donald Trump is a pretty awful thing to happen to your party. My God. So on so many levels, it just keeps on, keeps on coming. He's, for my party, he's the gift that keeps on giving, and, you gotta love him in a way. But I just wanted to bring that up because a lot of folks don't appreciate how important building up that list of contacts is, and how important mailing lists and data mining and so forth have become in modern American politics. And it's just hugely important. And that's the kind of nitty-gritty type stuff that the Trump organization is trying to do now. But it's so hard to play catch up on that sort of thing. It just takes time, and you can't buy that.
Right.
So.
Right.
All right, moving on to, I was going to say a non-political story, but it really isn't entirely a non-political, at least a non-election story. There's some potentially important news this week out of Virginia, where prolific Democratic fundraiser turned governor Terry McAuliffe used his executive authority to restore voting rights to over 200,000 convicted felons in the state. Now,
That's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. And it's a big deal because Virginia may be a swing state in the upcoming election, and that many potential new voters could possibly move Virginia more solidly into the Democratic column.
So I was going to ask you, how do convicted felons tend to vote? Any numbers on that?
Yeah, actually, there are some pretty solid numbers on that. Is that convicted felons, when they do vote, and most of them don't vote. So we're talking about, if average turnout is, say, around 35 or so percent, convicted felons, who have their voting rights restored, we're talking around 20% or so. And the vast majority of them vote for Democrats.
And
that's in large part because there's a high proportion of poor minorities, and those are votes that traditionally go to Democrats. So this has the potential, you know. So what we're talking about in terms of numbers is maybe you crunch the numbers around 0.5%. Now, 0.5% usually doesn't mean a whole lot, but in a close race, it can be important. And while neither of Virginia's senators are up for re-election this cycle, they've got 11 House races, and some of them are pretty close or are predicted to be pretty close. And, you know, that could make a difference there. So could be a big deal. And certainly I'm not suggesting that the Democratic governor had any partisan things in mind when he was doing that. But certainly just as much like the Republican screaming and yelling wasn't partisan, certainly not. But, I mean, we've seen this, I think, again and again and again. Democrats do whatever they can to enfranchise as many disenfranchised voters, because those are voters who, by and large, will vote Democrat if they vote. And Republicans do what they can to disenfranchise those voters, or at least make life difficult for them, because they know that, by and large, they'll vote Democratic.
Well, let me first pre-qualify my remarks by saying I'm actually for enfranchising convicted felons or allowing them right to vote after a certain period of time, depending on the nature of the felony. I mean, I think when people are convicted of crimes that go to the heart of the electoral or judicial system, I mean,
vote
that
fraud.
Kind of fraud type
yeah.
stuff, I would agree with a lifetime ban there. If a guy just got caught carrying a bunch of drugs and he's cleaned himself out and he's done his time and so forth, no, I quite honestly, I think those people ought to be fully reintegrated into society, including the right to vote.
Well, good for you, Jay.
I totally agree.
That's a very enlightened position, I got to say. Excellent.
Now that said, let's not pretend that this isn't political.
Of course,
by McAuliffe. Let's not pretend that, you know, listen, these folks who were convicted felons are convicted felons. It's not that they we're just all sort of at the wrong place at the wrong time, or that Republicans sort of set them up to be convicted so they could then disenfranchise them.
Right.
These are people who for one reason or another ran afoul of the law. And there ought to be some price to be paid for that. Part of that is sort of taking a time out from the rest of the society. But once they're done, they ought to be back in.
Yeah.
So I guess I'd contest your claim that Republicans are trying to disenfranchise them. It is sort of crass, you know, McAuliffe doing this. And I don't know enough about Virginia as far as whether there's any question about whether he has the authority to do this by executive order or whether it's something that has to be legislative. I don't know. I think in most states, it's something it's probably would have to be a legislative enactment.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. And in fact, that's what some Republicans are saying. What the governor claims is that's under his pardoning authority, and that can't be questioned or reviewed. A similar thing actually happened in.
But I would say if there's a statute to the contrary, that's a different issue. And again, I don't know that for sure in Virginia.
Well, and, you know,
I do know that for sure in Ohio, though. So.
A similar thing happened in Kentucky, where the outgoing Democratic governor essentially restored voting rights, and then the incoming Republican governor, so the outgoing Democratic governor restored voting rights, then the new Republican governor undid that, essentially. And again, I'm not saying that Republicans are uniquely evil here. It's all about where your votes come from. Democrats a few generations ago did the same thing. They tried to disenfranchise voters who they knew were going to vote for Republicans. So I get it. And it certainly is, you know, rank hypocrisy to claim that it's all this concern about, you know, democracy and people's rights and so forth. I think fundamentally for a lot of these folks, it's concerned about how is this going to hurt our chances in the upcoming elections. And, you know, and I get that. And hypocrisy is just part of what you do when you're a politician. But, you know, there certainly are political motives here. And I think they're front and center for both parties.
All right. Fair enough.
Okay. You know, Congress, we haven't talked a whole lot about Congress actually doing things recently, but believe it or not, Congress has actually been getting some stuff done in this last
week. What'd they do?
Well, on Wednesday, the Senate passed the first wide-ranging energy bill since the George W. Bush administration. And not only did they pass it, they passed it on a most definitely bipartisan vote of 85 to 12. The bill is called the Energy Policy Modernization Act. And what it did was, among other things, it promoted renewable energy. It included measures to improve the energy efficiency of buildings, and it should make it easier for fossil fuel producers to export natural gas. And actually, this bill was at the Senate, was on the Senate floor like 3 months ago, but it was delayed when Democrat Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, she held things up by pushing for $600 million for aiding the victims of lead poisoning in Flint, Michigan. And recently they kind of relented on that. And so the bill ran through. And so I think that's kind of a big deal. We always focus on congressional dysfunction, but this is a great example of Democrats and Republicans getting together. Of course, I think it helps a whole lot, the fact that since the fracking boom and so forth, is now we've become far more energy independent. And when resources are abundant in any area, it always makes it easier to legislate because there's just more to go around and people aren't
fighting.
There's
more money there.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's sort of why Willie Sutton robs banks. That's where the money is.
And, exactly.
Yeah.
So we should get some legislation. The House had passed a measure previously. And so this is something that, you know, much needed, that should get to the president's desk for a signature before too long. So yay, Congress, way to be all bipartisan-y and so forth. Nice news. Also this week, there was a Senate hearing on an Obama nominee that both Democrats and Republicans are predicting will have a clear path to confirmation. Now, sadly,
and who's that?
Sadly, it was not the nomination of the relatively moderate and eminently qualified Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. It was the nomination of Carla Hayden to be the next Librarian of Congress. Hayden would be the first woman and the first African-American in the job, as well as the first new Librarian of Congress since the Reagan administration.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and you know, you say, well, what's that?
Why does the president get to appoint the Librarian of Congress?
It's just how they wrote it up. In fact, it used to be a lifetime appointment. Essentially. In fact, until 2015, it was a lifetime appointment. But then Congress passed a measure that made it a 10-year term with the possibility of reappointment. And basically, the last Librarian of Congress who'd been in there for forever, well, since the Reagan administration, was kind of an old codger who didn't believe in those fancy computer machines and so forth. And the Library of Congress is really
bugging people about bringing stuff back overdue. And yeah,
exactly. You know, and so the Library of Congress was really in some sad shape, in fact. And it's not just a library. You know, a lot of people don't appreciate all the stuff that the Library of Congress does, but the Library of Congress is, you know, really important. For instance, it oversees the U.S. Copyright Office, which is a big deal. And right. So the previous Librarian of Congress was, from all accounts, a pretty bad administrator, not much of a librarian. I don't know how he got the job exactly, but he was well due to be out of the job. And he was essentially forced to retire. There was a lot of pressure put on him. And so, you know, this is a good thing. Library of Congress should have a good person in charge of it. And it looks like that's going to happen. So it's nice to see Congress do some positive stuff for a change.
Well, and I'll just throw out that, you know, one of the reasons that this is bipartisan and that the Librarian of Congress is Republicans are able to get behind the Librarian of Congress is because, quite honestly, her views on a lot of public policy, social policy, balance of power between our governmental branches doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
She is an administrator, and that's all you need is a competent administrator. And I think I just compare that to Merrick Garland, which would be a swing vote.
Sure.
In the Supreme Court, which has become more and more the arbiter of so much of our everyday life.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's important to point these things out because, you know, certainly Congress is not a well-oiled machine, but Congress, the people who say Congress is completely broken, I think this is evidence to the contrary, that on some basic administrative, some basic functioning things, and in some policy areas, there can be fairly broad consensus, broad agreement. Now, that's not the stuff that gets played up. Both of these stories were buried, of course, because the media focuses on conflict and dysfunction. But Congress isn't maybe quite as broken as some people think. It can get stuff done. And that's, you know, I think that's important to bring up.
Well, and the point I was trying to make, and I did so sort of inartfully, was it's understandable that there's opposition and argument over Supreme Court nomination, because that the stakes are that much higher.
Sure.
And I don't think it's, you know, to say, I guess if the label that's being applied to the Republicans for blocking or not having hearings on Merrick Garland is that they are simply obstructing for political partisan purposes.
Well, of course they are.
They are. But if that's the case, clearly they're not obstructing other folks. They're obstructing Garland because they think it's important.
Right.
And I guess that's the point I'm trying to make is, and no offense to the Library of Congress, it is important, but it's not as important as
sure.
the Supreme Court.
And, of course and not.
So.
No, absolutely.
They're
absolutely.
Picking the battles. And absolutely. And I think that's entirely appropriate.
Absolutely. Totally agree. So now, before we've kind of been getting away from doing more kind of offbeat kind of stories in the podcast. We've just been so filled with so many other things, but you have a couple of stories for us, don't you, Jay?
Well, two things, and this is just in honor of last Friday, I think, was Earth Day. I'm not sure what it, did you do anything particularly special for Earth Day?
I did absolutely nothing special at all for Earth Day.
It's also Lennon's birthday.
On the same day.
Just have same day. Yeah, imagine
wow.
that. there was a UN climate agreement signed. John Kerry brought his granddaughter. It was really cute.
It was a nice picture. And, yeah.
And it was a wonderful photo op, and Leonardo DiCaprio spoke. And I just want to point out sort of
what?
The futility
Wait,
of
what?
All of it.
What? Leonardo DiCaprio spoke?
Yeah. But,
okay.
You know, this agreement essentially says that all the signatories will set their own greenhouse gas emissions goals, targets. And, you know, it's sort of they will set them. And then if they don't meet them, well, then apparently then they're not met. Likewise, if another signatory who fails to meet their goal, it's a lot like saying, you know, all of us are going to you and I are going to both go on diets, and I plan to lose 20 pounds, you know, by Christmas, unless I don't.
I get it. Yeah, you know, we actually have this reminds me of a policy we have at my institution that I teach at. We instituted a no smoking policy, so we are officially a smoke-free campus, but a decision was made to have no actual enforcement or no penalties. And so right outside of my office window, what do I see between every class? Oh, probably about 10 to 20 students just puffing away. There's this kind of cloud of smoke. And so that's your point, obviously, you know, a policy with no enforcement isn't all that useful. And I absolutely agree. But I also think that for things like this, sometimes you need to take them in stages. So first you have a policy and get people to agree in principle. It brings everyone together. And then maybe you can kind of gradually bring in enforcement. So I understand what you're saying, but I think that sometimes these things have to be taken incrementally.
Well, that's probably an okay argument about taking things incrementally. But if you believe that the Chinese are going to comply with their targets, I think that's just sort of ridiculous.
No,
my point was, listen, we had this big hoopla, and we talked about future generations being saved. Even if everyone were to stick to their targets, the proposed savings would be a reduction in temperatures of 0.2 degrees Celsius by 2100.
That doesn't sound like a lot.
No. That's if everybody actually loses the weight and quits smoking like they promised they would. And there's also money changing hands where some countries like the U.S. would be providing assistance to other countries to help them develop clean energy technologies and yada, 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 which my sense is will go to someone's brother-in-law's solar plant. But it was a wonderful day regardless. And I do want to point out, though, also my other sort of just goofy offbeat story is as to where we are. The American Enterprise Institute every Earth Day sort of republishes some of the predictions from the first Earth Day.
And AEI is a conservative think tank.
They are. I would say they're conservative, libertarian-leaning.
Market-oriented, yeah.
Middle-of-the-road conservative. But just some of the highlights. Paul Ehrlich, who is probably familiar to some people, his book with the Population Bomb.
We're never going to live him down on the left.
You are. But he said back in 1970, of April 1970, population will inevitably and completely outstrip whatever small increases in food supplies we make. The death rate will increase until at least 100 to 200 million people per year will be starving to death during the next 10 years. That would be the 1970s. He also talked about in his article subtly titled "Eco-Catastrophe!" exclamation point. Some experts feel that food shortages will have escalated to the present level of world hunger and starvation into famines of unbelievable proportions. Other experts, more optimistic, think the ultimate food population collision will not occur until the decade of the 1980s. He predicted a great die-off between 1980 and 1989, where some 4 billion people, which would be, you know, essentially half of the Earth's population today, would die off, including 65 million Americans.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that didn't happen.
Also, the Life magazine reported in January 1970 that scientists have solid experimental and theoretical evidence. Again, this is science, and you can't argue with science.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
The following predictions that in a decade, urban dwellers will have to wear gas masks to survive air pollution. And by 1985, air pollution will have reduced the amount of sunlight reaching Earth by one half.
Now, when was this again?
This was January of 1970.
Okay, now right after that, not too far after that, some pretty important environmental legislation was passed. And so, I mean, couldn't the Clean Air Act, I think, was passed a few years after
fair,
that?
You know, so, no, fair enough. And I think that's a good argument, though. This is a dynamic system that we're talking about. And it's tough to make predictions. But, and you can say, you could all of these predictions, you could put the prefix or the forward of saying, unless something is done, this will happen.
And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I agree with you entirely that some of these predictions were totally ridiculous. And I think it's irresponsible to fearmonger on this issue. I get why people do it, because they want attention brought to the issue. And the idea is that, well, we'll exaggerate it. You know, we'll be like Al Gore showing pictures of the polar bear on the ice floe or whatever. And you know, that will get people to act. But I think it's fundamentally dishonest. And I have a problem with that, too. But which is not to say that I don't think there aren't very real problems. Now, you and I might disagree on that, but I think we do disagree that on using, well, on lying to people to get them to act. You know, I think that's what's obviously a dishonest thing, and I don't think there's any place for that.
Yeah. Just a couple more, just because this is fun.
For you, okay,
Ecologist Kenneth Watts. Again, and my point is these are respected academics and scientists.
Go ahead, cherry pick away, Jay.
By the year 2000, if present trends continue, we will be using up crude oil at such a rate that there won't be any more crude oil. That was in 2000. We have run out of oil, and of course, the issue right now is that the world is in something of an oil glut. And finally, that same Kenneth Watt had warned that, and this is in 1970. The world has been chilling sharply for about 20 years. And if present trends continue, the world will be about 4 degrees colder for the global mean temperature in 1990, but 11 degrees colder in the year 2000. And that's about twice what it will take to put us into an ice age.
Well, so there you go. There are random nuts on the left.
As we celebrate Earth Day, let us look back and take all the doomsaying with a grain of salt.
Oh, Jay. Okay. So much for Earth Day. Now you had one other story, didn't you?
I don't think so.
I don't know why. I thought you had something else. Go figure. All right, then.
I can keep giving you Earth Day predictions.
Oh, God, no, please. That's okay. Well, I think we'll
do a show just on Paul Ehrlich.
Oh, God.
Life expectancy in the U.S. would be 42 years by 1980.
That'll have to be a special solo show of the politics guys with just you, Jay. But maybe we'll do that for our more, I would say, climate change denying part of the audience or something like that. Whole nother issue.
I would say the open-minded skeptics.
The open-minded skeptics. Okay, we'll go with that phrase. All right. Well, then, on that note, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or any questions for our Ask the Politics Guys show, which comes out every Wednesday, we would love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. Our Facebook page, where Jay and I post and comment on news articles throughout the week, and where you can join in, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. If you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we'd really appreciate it if you could take a minute to rate the show and write a quick review. And if you like what we're doing and want us to be able to keep on doing it, a donation of even a dollar or two, the price of a Vermont American No. 3 spiral screw extractor would really help. You'll find donation links on our site, politicsguys.com. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.